This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. With your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Masserol. Are you ready to discover your True North Story?
What Tam and I are trying to do with True North Story is create a podcast platform where guests like yourselves engage and interact with our audience in a way that drives inspiration, encouragement, motivation, and hope. Those are the four things that we've kind of built this on. The takeaways from your story and from what you're doing that they can pull valuable pieces, applicable pieces for their own lives.
What we're trying to do.
Yeah, it sounds very similar, which is good because I think that's a message, you know, that's an empowerment message that we're trying to move more on the curve towards that end of the spectrum with content. What do you think about that more the traditional side of marketing history versus maybe where we're going into the future?
For me, I think it's hugely refreshing change. And actually, I was walking with the last time Will was down here in Asheville. We were walking and we were actually planning out our automated email welcome sequence. And we both said to each other and acknowledged that we want to invest time and resources and money into creating a really awesome welcome sequence that tries to sell people nothing, that only attempts to give people useful things and not be any sort of a sell or noise, and trust that if something is useful enough that somebody will be inspired to hop on a website and look more or whatever. And there was something from the creation side of marketing, there was something super freeing about operating under that perspective.
I love that. It's so true because anyone who's been in sales knows that it's constant pressure and you're trying to figure out a way to get in front of people. You're trying to figure out a way to manipulate people to get them to interact in a behavior that is beneficial to you and may be beneficial to them, but may not be. It's like even after you get a sale, sometimes I don't know this. This was true in my case, at least when I was in sales for a while. Sometimes you felt a little guilty. Even after you got the sale, like the elation is like, yeah, you know, my commission check, all right, you know. And then you're kind of like, did they really need that? Did I? Right? I mean, was that in their best interest? Or because it was obviously in my best interest. But Tam and I are trying to do a lot of that same thing of empowering people to feel better about themselves and feel better about the products they use and why they use them.
Will and Chad, you two are co-CEOs. You've got a TED Talk out there. You've got a cool book that you're launching. Were you friends, college friends, high school friends? How did you meet and decide that you wanted to start a company together?
I'm flattered that you thought we were friends or high school or college friends. Most people think that Will's my dad and I'm his son. an exaggeration. But so I met Will at Penn State and I was actually his student. I walked into a room and the way that I met Will is I walked in and there was this class I wasn't really sure about. It was supposedly going to teach me how to facilitate dialogues with strangers about contentious things. And I walked in, everybody, you know, there wasn't desks facing in the front of the room. There was a circle of 20 chairs or so. And so I'm already like, all right, what's going on here? And I sat down and Will started off the course of the training in 2 solid minutes of silence, just looking around the room, one person at a time, looking at each person in the eyes until he got all the way to the end.
Yeah, that's not awkward. Not at all.
It was memorable, I can tell you that.
I'm sure it was. The longest 2 minutes of your life.
and there were a couple of people for sure in the course that maybe this would have been you, John. I think I was also one of them who in that 2 minutes said something like, ah, what are we doing? What's happening?
Right.
It was just like, which is great. Yeah, but then Will after that said, are you ready? Are you ready for your life to change? Because if you stay in this class, if you stay in this course for the next 15 weeks, it's going to be impossible that you see the world in the same way. And if you're not interested in that, I would actually invite you to leave and come back another semester or when you're ready in that way. So that's how I met Will. It was quite an introduction.
And then one of the things that happened because of that is, you know, when you meet somebody and you're like, this person's going to make a difference in the world. I had been fortunate enough to train lots of people to lead. I knew that Chad had this special gift, and we had something in the class called self-work, and he always took it to the extreme and was, as a student, teaching others, not as kind of an expert way, but in an exploratory way. And he had found out some of the things I was doing outside of class. I want to do more of that. One day we just put our heads together and said, let's do it together. We both could do something together that we couldn't do alone. That synergy has made something really wonderful, I think, for both of us.
Let's just back up here 1 second. When Chad was describing the course about dialogue, engaging strangers in dialogue that may be of an uncomfortable nature, the elephant in the room right now is, of course, the free speech conversation that we're seeing in certain areas of academia, especially with Will. You're in academia. Tam and I teach a storytelling course at University of Washington in their professional continuing education certification program. Are you seeing people being less tolerant of opposing viewpoints under the guise of free speech or lack thereof? Tell us a little bit more about the course and what your thoughts are related to what we're seeing on college campuses as an intolerance of others' viewpoints.
I can give you an answer. Let's see if this answer satisfies you.
Okay. Well, it's not satisfying me. I want our audience to think about these things because it's really important.
So for years, I've been training people to walk into a room full of strangers and talk about things that nobody talks about. Race, gender, long-term conflict, climate change, with no agenda. Okay, so maybe there's a slight agenda. The agenda is we hope the conversation continues. I'm fortunate enough to have, if you walked into my classroom, you would say I have the most diverse classroom on campus. Sometimes the class is 20. We break it out in different formats. So sometimes it can be as many as 60 sitting in a circle. And if you look around, the number of language represented, the number of countries represented, the number of skin tones represented, you're like, well, you got a diverse classroom, especially outside of that classroom. Central Pennsylvania is quite white. Trump has given us a huge gift, actually, because we actually don't have a diverse classroom. And
okay.
What I mean by that is when you look around the room, you see diversity. You might hear diversity in language and such, but most of them, their thought are very similar. And this became clear to me recently because I used to work within farming organizations within Pennsylvania. And I got this clear image that we don't have somebody who milked the cow that morning, who's showing up with cow poop on their boots, walking into the classroom, whose dad voted for Trump, and who can stand in that place and have conversation with us because he would be attacked. There's a way that the students think they're open-minded, and they're open-minded for anybody who thinks the same as they do.
Right.
So, yeah, you look different than me. Let's have a conversation. Great. We both agree that things are screwed up, right? And we think they're screwed up in the same way. So one of the things that we are pushing toward is there's a selection process for students to be in my class. But how do we also create a space where that farmer's boy could also be in that class and say, I voted for Trump, and I think that, and say whatever he wants to say about migrant workers or people of color in a way that could really move the conversation forward. That is the cutting edge where we need to have the conversation, the places in which it makes our palms sweat. It's easy to talk about it when we agree on some level, but can we have the conversation where our palms are sweating?
That's so interesting. We've talked to others on this podcast who talk about critical thinking and how there's possibly
a lack thereof
in today's young people and the millennial generation.
I've, I've been, language that I've been using around this is I've been seeing, and I think fueled a passion and a fire for the work they were doing, is see this major national curiosity deficit. Mm. We hear, it's very, very easy to consume something, whether it's over social media or in person, although now much of the time over social media or some sort of electronic feed, and to see that and immediately have an opinion about it rather than see that and immediately have a question rooted in natural, genuine curiosity about it. And I think there's a way that the judgment that comes out on others' opinions that I think is a symptom of a lack of maybe critical thinking. I think that actually starts in the place of a lack of curiosity. When I hear somebody voted for somebody I agree with or don't agree with, I immediately put them in this box and I don't ask them what compelled them to vote. I just share why they shouldn't have in that way. And so
it's super interesting because I always joke with Tama. I guess it's not really joking because it's kind of a mantra for me, but I always say that I don't want to be put in a box. I look throughout life and the older I get, it's like it's all about boxes. It's all about it's identifying people by what box you're in. You know, whether it be a professionally, whether it's personally, whether it's geographically, whether it's religiously, whether it's politically, it's just so mind-numbing to me. It's like you're an individual and you're capable of being conservative fiscally and politically. You can be a Christian and be supportive of the Islamic religion. I mean, I don't get where it's like, gotta be, you're that. You know, nothing else you say, I don't hear you. It's like you got fingers in your ear, na 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 na. Like, I know who you are. You're a white supremacist. That's who you are. And it seems to me like so detrimental to us as a society going forward. We're supposed to be more evolved than ever. What is happening?
Yeah, I really like what you're saying. It's almost, if I could be a little playful here, you're almost saying, there's no box for me. It is true that we put labels on things to make it easy. And, you know, going back to your critical thinking, I totally agree with Chad about the curiosity. And our education is set up in such a way that our job is to prove, not to improve. And so I prove that I know the right answer, right? Or prove, lots of different ways that proving shows up. But this idea of trying to improve gets in the way. And so one of the things that happens in our work and that was talked about in the book with Ask Powerful Questions, Create Conversations That Matter, is that people try to put Chad and I in a place that we're experts. And it's true that we have been thinking about this whole communication thing for most of our lives. And as soon as somebody puts me in the role of expert, and I agree to that, right? I accept, okay, I'll be the expert here.
Right.
I'm now in a box. And when I'm in that box, you are no longer distinctly you. You are every other person that I've met that's somewhat like you.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see you for who you are. And so one of my challenges as a speaker, facilitator, and a trainer is to really be in an explorer mode rather than an expert mode. And sure, an explorer shows up and knows how to use their map and their compass and their tools that they have with them. And they have to look at everything around them with new and fresh eyes. And so the explorer piece that Chad is talking about, or the curiosity piece, is a requirement of this explorer mentality. And I think our education system has really pushed us to be experts and to prove and not to be explorers and to be curious.
That's really powerful. You know, I mean, my father was an educator, a principal, and had his master's in history. He always had his face in a book. I mean, always reading. And he pushed us to explore and read more. And I still, to this day, I've got like no less than what, Tama, 4 or 5 books going at one time. I'm reading. And I love that. You know, I love just that quest for knowledge. And I still see new words in books that I've never seen before to add to my vocabulary. I just want to continue that growth and that intellectual stimulation and that curiosity, to your point. And I feel like that some people come at it from the perspective that they already know. They are already
right
in the expert mode, or that they already have the prerequisite skills to be able to do the job. And I remember this, and I was just going to say this because it just struck struck me so wrong, and I want to get your take on it. I remember, I think it was Jen Psaki with the Obama administration who said this when they were talking about their administration at the State Department. And she said, well, you know, this was her direct quote, you have to fake it until you make it. And then, of course, everybody picked up, and we've heard that 1,000 times in 1,000 different applications. And it just rubbed me the wrong way. I'm like, no, you don't have to fake it till you make it, because you're telling me you're something you're not. Okay, and so you're trying to get me to believe that you're something that you're not while you're trying to figure out how to become that something. Why not just tell me you're on a journey to become that thing? I would be much more empathetic to helping you and to being supportive of your journey than to tell me you're something that I clearly know you're not.
You know, something that you're saying, you're hitting on, like, what does it take to create a relationship of trust with another person? I'm hearing for you, it's really important to have that authenticity or that transparency of, like, hey, here's me, sort of going back to what we talked about before in relation to having a failure resume and this
right.
concept of a resume where you put, like, here is the ideal me look, so shiny,
right.
as opposed to, like, here's all the terrible ways that I've messed up and here's where I'm actually at. This is where I'd like to go.
It's so much more liberating to own your failures, for me personally. I mean, I know people might come at that from, that's a sign of weakness, or that's, I see strength in that. To say, hey, you know what, I started a business, I started a retail ice cream franchise, we weren't able to make it, and we had to close it, you know, 6 years later. I own that.
This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live.
Hey life, look at me, I can see the real time.
A little bit about resume of failures, Chad. That's really interesting.
Will's laughing.
I can't remember who I got the idea from, but essentially the concept is, you picture, even from down to the design, you picture exactly what a resume looks like. So your name's at the top, and usually we put all of the work experience and education experience and extra whatever experience that we're proud of or want to share or think will make someone think we are worthy of whatever we're sending that resume in for. The exact opposite of that would be, you've got the your name on the top, the design, and then instead of all your experience that makes you most proud, you list out all the ways that you've totally screwed up, messed up, failed, dropped the ball, and then the bullets underneath, instead of managed budget of $37 million, blah, 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 you're putting bullets of, this is what I learned from that experience. Example of that would be, I think on the top of my failure resume, some work that we did we're facilitating a company retreat for a client overseas, and both Will and I were facilitating, and we were so excited to work with this client. Very, very neat culture, really wonderful people. Felt like we had understood them really, really well going into this retreat. Had lots of calls beforehand to kind of get a sense of their culture, and we showed up and we led this, it was a day and a half long retreat in Spain, and after the first workshop, we're just kind of mingling around, collecting some feedback, and people are very politely saying, like, oh, this really, like, hit the mark exactly. And what we realized was, we did not empathize enough. The company was really diverse. There was 40 citizenships in this 170-person tech company.
Wow.
And we came at it from our American lens. So the dominant feedback that was received after that first piece, or that first section of the workshop afterwards, was, this was too American. And Will and I had to, like, sit back and really, like, what does that mean? Like, we spent our life talking about culture and kind of unpacking all of that, and this is the first time we've ever got this feedback. Like, what is that? And I think for me, and Will, I'd love to hear your perspective on this now, being almost a year removed from this experience. One of my takes is, I don't feel like I empathized enough with what was normal for them or what they liked and appreciated in the style of mostly the style of learning that they were accustomed to or drawn to in some way. Took favorite client, didn't empathize enough. We haven't, at least for a retreat, we haven't worked with them. I've continued to coach their CEO. So I guess there's still a relationship of trust that ended up there in some place. I would label that a failure.
What was your take on that, Will?
If I was to say it quickly, it's a great example where I showed up as an expert. And when I show up as an expert, failure often shows up afterwards. I've been doing diversity stuff within organizations for millennia, right? I'm not quite that old, but for a long time. And so it was easy for me to go, oh, we got this, and our tools will land. And as soon as I had that mindset, I couldn't see anything. As soon as I'm an expert, I'm only looking for things that support my worldview. And when I start going, oh, well, wait a minute, are those two speaking English? No, what, and asking myself what is actually going on and being really curious. I think Chad and I could have delivered the same material in the same way. And if we would have done it from the mindset of an explorer, we would have had much more success. But because we were coming in as the expert, nobody wants to be fixed.
Right.
So true.
Right.
Nobody wants to be fixed.
People want to be heard. They want to be understood. In our work, people want tools and an ability to create the life that they're dreaming or they're working on. There was moments where I was like, here's what's going to fix you. Here, I'm Dr. Know-It-All. Here's the prescription. Take two pills. Call me in the morning. And they're like, this pill's too bitter and it's too American and I don't like it.
You know, that's super interesting. Everyone is broken. So we all know that. I mean, there's no one on this planet that's not unbroken in some way. So there is fixing that needs to be done. But what I love about what you say is the method from a perspective of encouragement or a perspective of, have you thought about this? It's really interesting, like with the class that I teach at UW, I come in, I'll tell my students, I am not the resident expert of storytelling. There's a million different ways. There's a million different resources. You can go out, you can find someone who will argue my point, the opposite of my point. And that's up to you to go out and to augment. I'm just here to try and provide a collaborative, safe, comfortable environment for us to explore storytelling together and to learn together and to learn from one another. That collaborative aspect is more kind of what you're talking about, where they feel they have a voice and they feel that they're empowered and that what you're doing is helping them. Is that what you're talking about, Will?
Yeah, I would say the way that you are saying it, you could definitely be on our team. there's a way that Chad and I really desire to create experiences that build connection, belonging, trust. And you can't force that, but what you can do is create an experience where it's an easy choice for people. And when
for
they
sure.
start making those choices and they start seeing it for themselves, they get to decide, right? And they get to decide how much and how little, and they get to decide to what level that they're willing to participate. And, you know, sometimes we're presenting in front of thousands of people about questions and listening, and then we get them up to do that. But we have to do it when Chad and I do it well, in such a way that people can protect that sensitive part that they're not ready to share. They can come right up to that edge and share as much or as more of that. They find their own way to navigate that. Go ahead, Chad.
Well, I'm thinking about, John, what you shared and the way that you start your class, storytelling class, by saying, hey, I'm not the resident expert. There's a lot of other ideas out there. One other way that might be fun for us here and for your listeners, language that I've found myself using over and over, is this idea that, and 3 days ago, actually, I was just working with doing a facilitation training. And there were 10 people in the room that had all had 15 to 20 years more experience facilitating training and coaching than I had. And I was in the role of trainer with them. And so the way that for me, I open up that wanting to maintain that humility, be in the explorer role rather than the expert role, is saying, I'm not the expert here. And my perspective is that you are the expert of your own experience, because nobody else knows your life, your context, your situation, your practice better than you. And so my invitation to you in this moment is to ruthlessly misinterpret every single thing that I say and apply it to your own context.
I
and adjust it, misinterpret it, change it. there's something that right there, this, I have yet to say that to a group of folks and to not have them like sigh appreciatively, like,
right.
Ah, cool. This is kind of neat. I'm excited now. It puts them in the driver's seat and completely removes me from, it still means that I can share an idea and an opinion or ask a question, but mm-hmm. they are then in the driver's seat. And so I think it's just one single way, one small way that with language, we can empathize with everyone's desire for autonomy. No one wants to feel like you're being taught or talked at or facilitated or whatever. No one wants to feel like they are being controlled in the same way that no one wants to be helped. And so I think phrases like that give people language for is this idea of challenge by choice, inviting people to step into a challenge or step into a new idea and test out that new idea, but to choose to do it, not to do it because they're obliging one of us or they're doing it because they have to or whatever. Wanting to make sure that choice is very present.
Talk a little bit about your book, what it is, and how you are hoping people will apply it to their own experience.
Well, we've got quite a few different products. We've got Reconnect cards. Chad's got a book. The book that we're excited about right now is Ask Powerful Questions, Create Conversations That Matter. One of the things I'm most excited about it is if you pick up the book and flip through any page and read a couple pages, most likely you'll land on a place where there's a skill set or a tool that you could pick up and use. And that would change your life. However, if you integrate the whole model together from the bottom where intention starts all the way up to empathy and everything in between and start using them together as the model helps you through this process of doing that, they start locking together and connecting together in such a way that your life begins to transform. And when I've shared this with the material in this book over the last 10 years with students, the reason why we ask, are you ready for your life to change at the beginning, is because once you're in this, something shifts dramatically. Your mindset shifts, your desire to connect and build relationships that matter. You were talking about manipulation before, your desire to eliminate manipulation out of your life and really be in a place where you're following your curiosity and exploring what the truth is, being clear about what your intention is. When you start connecting all of those, there's a way that your life will transform. Not just change, but actually transform. And you can have tools to create the life that you want to be living.
Will and I were chatting with this guy named Bob Keady the other day, and Bob's 65 years old, let's say. He wrote a book called Great Leaders Ask Questions, and we were Skyping with him, and he had just finished reading Will's book, Ask Powerful Questions. The way he introduced us, he goes, he's in Texas now, but he goes, listen, guys, I'm a simple guy. I grew up in North Dakota on a farm. When I read a book or I write a book, I'm looking for low-hanging fruit. Like, I'm a simple, like, give it to me straight. Like, give me a simple ideas. His words after that were, or my question actually was, so having read the book, tell me, what was some low-hanging fruit, but first, who is this book for? And his answer was, he thought about it for a minute, and he goes, this book is for every leader who has a desire to be a better leader. And then he goes, actually, that's not it. It's for every serious leader who has a desire to be a better leader. Because I think that in our traditional lens of leadership and that role is that traditionally it's I direct or I give orders and move. And I think what Will's done in this book has put together an alternative to that, which is a way of asking questions to build a relationship of trust with somebody and build a level of empathy and setting clear intention that creates a path for like clearer communication, but also more trusting, more fulfilling autonomous communication too. Autonomous means like giving people the reins of their work and their life, which I don't think that always happens with bosses in some way.
Well, I think one thing to add to what Chad is saying that might help people understand where we're coming from is a leader is anybody who can make something happen that wasn't going to happen anyway. make something happen that wasn't going to happen anyway. A manager is really good at keeping everything the same. Whatever the systems are, let me know what the systems are. Put out the fire so the system can go back to normal. And their job is to keep things the same. Now, neither one is wrong or right. But in this case, we're really trying to communicate with leaders who are ready to make something new happen that wasn't going to happen anyway.
Learn, love, listen, live. This is True North Story, the original podcast series. And now, back to the program.
Walk out, Bill, don't you walk out. We got things to say. Talk out, let's have it talked out and things will be okay.
I keep hearing the word intention coming up as part of your model. And what's interesting about intention is that we've heard that with a lot of other previous podcast guests, talking about being intentional. Can you speak to that just a little bit?
Sure. Go ahead.
Will, can I share a story first? I'm jumping in somewhat eager because the story I'm about to share is very fresh. 6 hours ago, I was crying with my wife sitting at our kitchen table, and part of those tears were coming from Will's darn book and this darn idea about intention in chapter one. Be clear about your intention and state it in the conversation, which is really, really simple. And yet most of the time we don't actually make our intention clear. The snapshot of it is I had gone to church with my wife this morning, which is not a regular occurrence for me, and I'm still figuring out what that whole relationship looks like, but it's a huge part of Kate's life. And so being married to Kate in this moment, that's created some tension where it's kind of this difficult issue where I have all these questions, but I don't necessarily want to question where she's at, as it's so fulfilling. I don't need to undermine that in some way. So anyway, we're in the middle of this difficult conversation. I just paused. And I looked right at Kate and I said, I think that it would be helpful if I share this intention. And my intention in having this conversation is that I would love for, at the end of our conversation, I would love to be in a place where when we talk about religion, spirituality, or we go to church or whatever, that you're not concerned about my experience, that I'm not overly concerned about your experience, that we're both able to have conversation that feels fluid and comfortable and natural to have. And that's it. Just like painting that intention of like, here's the future state. And yes, we're in like the thick of a hard conversation right now, but we could very easily both align on that intention and that future state. Whereas if I didn't share that, we would have just gone back and forth and probably had some dialogue or debate about doctrine or some philosophy. And we would have transferred between like logical reasoning and spiritual feeling and whatever. And we would have ended up in some place that was
not necessarily where you wanted to end up, potentially.
Yeah. Right? Where would you know get to where you're going if you don't state where you're aiming to go? And not that intention always paints that that future state or place to go. Sometimes an intention can be, hey, my intention right now is to be dominantly listening to you and not spouting my opinion. That's a huge tone.
I am big into Eckhart Tolle or Toll, however you want to pronounce his last name, and being in the moment and understanding what that is and being present. And I think when you ascribe to live your life that way, it changes your conversations a little bit because you're here. It tends to minimize the ego a little bit and exacerbate the humility piece that Will was referring to earlier, which is a good thing. Because you're like, I'm just right here, right now. And so, like, for example, to use your church example with your wife, Kate, if you're both there, you know, it's not so much about why you're there or what's Kate thinking about your experience, what are you thinking about her experience. You're just in that moment. together. And maybe that conversation is a lot easier to have if you're both just present in that moment. Just something to think about. Who knows?
No, thank you. Thanks for sharing that. I feel like you illuminate, and I'm really curious to hear Will's perspective on this and the link between being present and intention, because I think there's a strong one. Cool that you just recognized that, John, or like saw that in the in that story and in that moment. Will, I'm really curious what's baking over there.
Well, I think you're right in that when you get clear about your intention, it makes you super sharp to what's happening right now in the present moment. And it makes you sharp to what you could then create, right? The possibility that you can create from this present moment into the next moment. So the root word of intention comes from to stretch. And really good intentions aren't just about you, but they stretch you to also include the other. And so a powerful thing to consider as you're about to walk into the next meeting is not necessarily your agenda items, but what is your intent? And, you know, I sometimes ask this question when we lead company retreats, and people on some level feel like they have to be there because their boss told them, we're doing this company retreat and you're required to come. And yet they show up, right? They have some choice in the matter because they're actually showing up. And so asking them to get clear about their intent, even in the field of feeling like they were forced to show up. And once they get clear about what that intention is, and they can communicate that to another, there's something that's going to happen that wasn't going to happen anyway, right? They have a ability to see and hear things in the present moment that they wouldn't have. They would come in. It's easier to come in with your old baggage about the way things have always been done rather than create a clear intent and make something new happen. The word intention also has this other meaning, which is to heal a wound. And this is why intention is really, especially thinking about your True North listeners and thinking about creating the life that we want to create, is that if you're in a conversation, so using Chad's example, he clearly states his intent, maybe she does as well, the conversation moves along, it gets suddenly very heated again, people's fists are tightening up, and what could happen, not to suggest that Chad's hitting anybody, but you know that what I mean when you start tensing up. And you start tensing up, and you can pause right there and say, whoa, hold on. What's our intent? And it can bring you back to whatever that intention is and clearly state that intent again. And so often what I see when conflict is really large, so large that it's really combat in workplaces and in families, is they think they know what the other person's intent is, but they really don't know what the other person's intent is. And get the other person's intention, something new can be birthed from that place.
Is that because we are, as people, we don't express intention, or we have ulterior motives with intention? What do you think it is, Will?
Well, I love that you asked that question. That's really beautiful. And I talk about the American society as a whole and go back to this prove and improve idea there and back to the manipulation piece that John brought up earlier. There is a way that we are encouraged to manipulate. Sales, teaching, so much of this is about manipulation. Here's the interesting thing about intent. If your intent is made clear, manipulation is not possible. So even as a salesman, if you walked in and said, my intent here is to sell you $100,000 worth of material, and I'm not suggesting you do this, but if you said that right up front, my intent is to sell you $100,000 worth of materials, tell me what you need. That's no longer manipulation, because now the other person knows the game that we're playing. And when everybody is clear about the game, the manipulation really is about getting somebody else to do something without telling them that's what you want them to do.
Influencing, manipulation, inadequacy marketing, fear. We're just talking in the book that I'm using for our storytelling class. It's Winning the Story Wars by Jonah Sacks. And in the book, he talks about the history of marketing. And, you know, a lot of the inadequacy marketing came from you feeling inadequate because you didn't have what somebody else has. And marketing playing upon those fears and saying, hey, your neighbor just got a new car. You know, now don't you think you need to get a new car? And if he got a Buick, you need to get a Cadillac. That whole thing. And I just love the way that I feel like marketing is aspects of marketing, and marketers and people like yourselves are getting it. We're moving away from that old 100-year-old model into something that is more empowering and encouraging and inspirational and honestly aspirational.
Yeah, what would it look like if you walked into whatever your next meeting is, no matter what it is, and met the person, maybe you know them for 100 years, or maybe this is your first time meeting, and say, what's your intent with this meeting?
Love it. Yeah. Well, actually, I just wanted to kill an hour on a Monday, and, Exactly, right?
Chad asks a really great question oftentimes with our clients. It kind of flips. I ask the same question, but flips it is, how will we know, say your meeting's for an hour, how will we know at the end of this meeting that we were successful? And again, it's just a really beautiful question that gets down to the root of intention and putting that clearly on the table so that we all know the game that we're playing. As long as we all know the game that we're playing, then manipulation doesn't get a chance to sit at the table.
Just one last question, real quick on that. Do you think... Yeah, one last question. Do you think that value plays a role in the intention too, from a standpoint of like, if you can point to the value of that meeting, for example, to use your example, maybe two or three takeaways, that kind of can be coupled with intention in a meaningful way?
The thought that jumped to my mind immediately, and then if you want to dovetail off this, Will, I don't think we've ever talked about this, Will, but I'm curious to parse out the words purpose and intention. But when you say value, at least what's strikes me, or what came to my mind is there's a book called The Purpose Economy, and it talks about how essential it is to have purpose in our work, which is like, okay, yeah, got it. So often we spend loads of time in activity and action and doing something or meeting and not necessarily getting clear on that purpose or intention. And so in my right now, at least what's coming up for me is that intention is almost the hits on the process more than the content or more than the result. So the purpose might be in a sales meeting to go over last year's numbers, for example. The intention, at least oftentimes I find when I'm stating my intention, the intention is more about the process of how we're going to talk about those numbers. And so my intention in this meeting is to listen for ways that I can be helpful as a leader, listen for ways that I can be helpful next year in this process, which is different than the purpose or the goal of going over last year's numbers, for example. Those are my 3 cents.
If I'm really honest with you, I don't see your intention with this question.
I'm thinking that if, and I guess it's highly subjective, because value to 10 people sitting in a meeting could mean 10 different things, right? Their perceived value from that hour spent in that meeting could all be very different. Some could say it was a waste of time. Some could say, no, I'm inspired. Someone else could say, I learned one thing. My question was merely, can you link valuable takeaways?
Maybe this may help answer your question. At least this is how an answer is showing up for me right now. Is that will, so I'll ask it as a question, will a meeting be more valuable if people clearly state their intention in the beginning, and or when things get really sticky, they repeat the intention, same words or different words, it doesn't matter, as long as it's clear and it lands for the others. Are they more likely to have a valuable meeting doing that than not doing that?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking?
Yes, I like that. That's perfect.
And what's your answer to that?
Yes.
Yes.
Chad and Will, what a delight to have spoken with you both. Tell us, for our listeners who would love to engage with you, find your materials, possibly talk with you about leadership training with their business, how do they find you?
Thanks for asking. If folks listening want a free snippet of Will's book, Ask Powerful Questions, the 12 printable We Connect cards, which is a deck of cards with 60 questions that invite people to connect and build accelerate building trust in new ways. You can go to weand.me /ideas. And if it's not there, you get a free excerpt of the book and 12 printable cards with a whole bunch of different ways to use them at a next meeting to make that intention and that connection and that trust come alive a little bit more, and to not have the meeting on Monday where the intention was to waste an hour. So
we all know we've been in those meetings too.
For sure. Yeah, the URL is a little strange. It's not a .com, so it's weand.me/ideas. There's one thing that's showing up for me that if I'm listening to a podcast, I want to, and I think it's John and Tam, both your intentions, that when people press stop or go to the next one or take their earbuds out or get out of the car, wherever that is, that there's something really tangible to take up.
Yes.
My invitation for people or challenge for people that would be very practical is in their next meeting, start off the meeting with what I would call just like a simple sentence completion. And you'd have to take 2 minutes in order to do this. So say there's 6 people in the meeting, take 2 minutes, give everybody 30 seconds to a minute to think about filling in this sentence. My intention for the next hour is ... So give people some silence to either think about that or write about that. And then it's only going to take 10 to 15 seconds per person. You just whip around the room and just hearing those 6 intentions. You don't even necessarily need to do anything with it, but there's something magical about just getting that out there to kick off the meeting and then going exactly where you were going, as long as that's transparent.
I love it.
Chad, fantastic.
Chad and Will, thank you so much for being part of our True North story. We've got a lot of synergy, and I hope we can stay in touch.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
I really appreciate your enthusiasm and desire to inspire. It definitely comes across as we were talking where you are wanting to uplift humanity and very committed to that. And I felt it, and I am touched by that. So thank you.
Nightingale. Sing us a song.
Thank you for listening to True North Story, the series. And tune in next time for another True North Story.
Nightingale, tell me your tale. Was your journey far too long? Does it seem